Dog Works Radio Network presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Michelle Forto standing in tonight for my husband Robert, who is out on the trail. They are safe and sound in Yetna Station, but we'll get into their little piece of mushing here in a few moments. On the line with me, I've got my partner in crime, Alex Stein, and we are ready to take on, I believe we're doing day six of Iditarod
27.
Day seven. I'll have to correct that on the link. Everybody has to forgive me. It's been a while since I was the producer.
It's great to be with you, Michelle, today. And I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about what Robert's up to. It's been a very busy and exciting day in Iditarod. So should we just dive right into that?
I say we should just dive right into that. I wasn't able to catch a lot of the happenings today other than I did see Wade Mars made it into the checkpoint in Unicolete today first.
Yep.
Awesome.
Yeah, so basically what happened is Mitch, since we were on the air yesterday, Mitch Seavey just kept going and going and going, and he still had his mandatory eight-hour rest on the Yukon River to take, and he went all the way to the last checkpoint on the Yukon, which is Caltag. So he was about, I think, 50 or 60 miles ahead when he came into Caltag. So then he had to take his 8-hour rest there. And while he was in, Dallas Seavey, Nick Pettit, Wade Mars, and Yur Olsom all came into the checkpoint. But because they had all come off of relatively long runs, they all stopped in Caltag, and then Mitch was able to be the first team out of Caltag. Dallas left about 5 minutes after Mitch. So there's, you know, not to get all armchair psychiatrist about this, but there's some interesting family dynamics and adversarial relationship between the two of them. So Dallas went out. Go ahead.
There's nothing wrong with a healthy competition amongst family members, you know. Makes Thanksgiving much more interesting.
Definitely. And then the others chased after them. Mitch stopped in the middle of the day before he got to Unalakleet. He stopped for about 3 hours at one of the cabins. I believe it was Old Woman Cabin. And then Wade Mars and Nick Pettit and Yur Olsom all passed him. And Wade was significantly ahead, but Nick kept whittling down on his lead. And Wade came into Unalakleet first, got the First of the Coast Award. But Nick Pettit was only 3 minutes after him. Mitch had, it's not a real big secret that Mitch and Dallas are both planning to run a variation on how they ran the race last year, which is to basically make it from Caltag to White Mountain in 4 runs. So they were going to stop before Unalakleet and then go through Unalakleet to Shaktulik, and then one more stop before they got to White Mountain, just before Elam. And it looks like Mitch is keeping with that schedule. So Mitch is now past Unalakleet on his way up to Shaktulik, and Wade and Nick Pettit and now Dallas are all resting in Unalakleet.
Well, you know, that is quite the pace to be setting. I think that those top five or six mushers probably can keep up that pace, but that's what's going to make this last few days so interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's also very interesting because Mitch, even though he's out in front, he is consistently running at a much higher speed than the others in that top group. So for someone like Dallas or Wade or Nick to catch Mitch and win this race, they're going to have to either speed up significantly or be able to figure out a way to make do with a lot less rest. So it's going to be interesting to see if any of them can put that together on this last 300 miles.
Yeah, that will be something to watch for. So what other things of interest are happening, you know, I guess middle of the pack, back of the pack, what's going on there?
Yeah, so we're kind of spread out now, much more so than we have been before. We had one scratch overnight. Ryan Anderson scratched, who we talked about yesterday on the show. He had spent 36 hours in one of the checkpoints, which we were hoping was not a bad sign. It turns out that that he felt like his dogs couldn't continue safely, so he scratched for the good of his team. But we have right now the current Red Lantern is Ellen Halverson, who is between Galena and Huslia. Roger Lee, who is a rookie, is also a little bit ahead of Ellen. And then the people that we're seeing at the back of the pack are the ones we've pretty much seen at the back of the pack for the last few days. Cindy Abbott, Jimmy Liebling, Peter Ruder, Michael Baker, Matt Failer. So that's what's going on in the back of the pack. We've got a lot of we pretty much have everyone having completed their 24-hour rest at this point. And there's a couple of people who are just finishing their 8-hour Yukon River rests. So by this time tomorrow, everyone should have completed all of the mandatory rests except for the White Mountain rest, which you know, sometimes people don't really count because every team basically has to stop when they get to White Mountain for 8 hours before they can continue.
Right, right. So, but no other big issues going on with the back of the pack or the middle of the pack people. So that's good. I know that they have had a few things popping up as far as these dogs that are expiring, you know, sadly. Overheating is a big deal, and I can talk about that a little bit when we talk about Robert's expedition. But who is our featured musher tonight?
So our featured musher tonight is Gunnar Johnson. And before, do you want to get into the hyperthermia before we get to Gunnar?
Yeah, sure. I can absolutely get into hyperthermia. So Robert and the students from the University of Alaska Anchorage set out this morning from Eagle Quest, and they are currently parked at Yetna Station. It's about 35-mile trek. And we got the dogs loaded up this morning here at the house and took them to Eagle Quest and got everybody out and on the trail by 10 o'clock this morning. Now, we were very concerned because that was already a little bit late, already getting a little bit warm. And you have to understand, warm for us is relative. If it's 20 degrees above zero, getting warm here. The temperatures peaked in Willow today at 30 above. And Robert did report the trail was good, hard and fast, but one of our dogs did get a little bit overheated, so they pulled her, put her in the sled, let her ride out the last few miles, and then pulled her out and had her finish the last 2 miles on the line, and she did just fine. So when a dog gets overheated, they're unable to pant enough and to literally sweat because of the colder temperatures, and it can cause them to expire. You have to be very mindful of your temperatures. 20 above here when you're running, let's say, like a, like Alex, let's say you're jogging on the beach down there in California, okay? And it's 40 degrees in the morning. It's going to be a high of 65 today. You're not likely to want to get up and run at 40 degrees, but you're going to enjoy your run better at 40 than you're going to enjoy it at 65 because it's just going to be too hot. So for the dogs, at 20 degrees, it feels like 65 degrees to them. So we really need that temperature to be closer to zero or even below zero for the dogs to feel a little bit more comfortable about exercising. And the worst thing you can do is put a dog that has been out in that cold temperature into a warm environment, like a 65 degree house or vehicle or anything like that, because the temperature extreme can be, you know, 60, 80 degrees difference, and that's going to make you feel hot too. So that's a little bit of the perspective there as far as how we look at it for temperatures. Our dogs are ran and trained mostly at night in temperatures that are between 10 degrees above zero and 20 degrees below zero, and that's, they really like that below zero temperatures. So,
yeah, and I think that's part of the reason why this race so far has been such a fast one, is that at least at the beginning, the temperatures were very, very low, 30 or 40 degrees below zero in some cases. And while that's very, very difficult for humans, that is a great temperature for these sled dogs. And they really are able to thrive and to just run very, very well when it's, you know, 20 or even 30 degrees below zero.
Well, nobody likes 30 degrees below zero. What happens at 30 degrees below zero, between the difference between 20 below and 30 below is pretty significant, but the difference between 10 below and 20 below isn't that much. So it's really hard to put a feel to that. But when a dog is running at optimal health, speed and condition at 30 below, the calorie intake has to be dang near tripled for what they have normally been in their normal temperatures for training. So that has to be taken into consideration because you're burning through much more calories at that temperature. The mushers hate it. They absolutely hate it because once you get to past 20 below, it's hard to function. It's hard to breathe air in. It's hard to take a deep breath. Your fingers get stiff. You might not necessarily be numb or experiencing frostbite, but you're going to definitely be moving at a slower motion. So I hate it myself, but you know I'm from California, so.
Right. The coldest I've ever been was close to 40 below zero, between 35 and 40 below zero. In McGrath, and when it is that cold, it hurts to breathe. It's very uncomfortable to breathe in air that's that cold that then comes into your body, which is, you know, presumably 98.6 degrees or thereabouts. So that is very difficult. And one of the things that happens is without realizing that you're doing this, you're getting less oxygen into your body, and you start kind of slowing down a little, not only in your physical movements, but also in your thinking. And that can be a very dangerous thing if you don't quite know what you're doing and you're starting to make a mistake when it's that cold. And we've seen on not so much in Iditarod, but when people climb Mount Everest and it's, 70, 80 degrees below zero, people will sometimes have so little oxygen, even though they're carrying oxygen with them in what they call the death zone, that they'll do things like they'll take off their glove and they'll be doing something with their bare hand and they won't register that they need to put their glove back on. And that's the sort of thing where you can very quickly get frostbite. You can very quickly, get to the point where you would lose fingers or something. So
you're talking
it's not quite that cold.
Right. You're talking about a matter of seconds in those situations. I can tell you the coldest I've experienced here in Willow, and we're pretty low. I mean, McGrath is much farther north than we are. We're just 75 miles north of Anchorage, and the coldest I've experienced was minus 35. And we were at negative temperatures for a good solid 10 days. And by the time we got to negative 35, I can tell you it's a burning sensation you feel when you're breathing. And you want to have your game plan. You're going to get out there and do what you need to do and get inside as quickly as possible because it is just so difficult to even breathe, like you said. So, you know, not everybody wants to endure those types of temperatures, but the listeners need to understand the dogs have been acclimated to those temperatures. It's not like we just took them out of a van at 65 degrees above zero and said, okay, guys, here we go. We're dropping you. We're going to go on this little run and it's 30 degrees below zero. Have a good time. That's not how it happens.
Right. And for most of these sled dogs, they have dog houses, but for the most part, they are outside. So they have some protection definitely from the wind and from the elements. But it's not like, as you said, it's not like these are inside dogs who are, you know, sitting around where it's 65 or 70 degrees, and then you take them out to negative temperatures. The other thing I wanted to mention real quickly is, and this always, I love how this shocks friends of mine in California, but compared to being at 30 or 35 degrees below zero, when you get to where it's only about 10 below zero, especially if it's 10 below zero and there's a little bit of sunshine, that actually can feel really nice if you are, you know, dressed properly, as my dad used to say when I was growing up, and if you are moving. So you wouldn't want to be sitting somewhere outside and not doing any activity. But if you're moving around and there's a little bit of sunshine, 10 below zero is not too bad.
No, 10 below zero is actually perfect because it keeps you from overheating and sweating, and it keeps you where you're able to function and enjoy yourself. For instance, today my concern on the trail for Robert and the students was the fat bikers actually overheating as the dogs can, because it's really tough to really figure out how to dress appropriately. I mean, you're in the trees and it could have been 20 degrees above zero, and then you pop down on the river and it could be zero. You know, the temperature difference can really fluctuate just in the difference in terrain here. And that's tough on bikers because they're not going to be able to take off layers and put more layers on. They just kind of got to keep going. And if you've ever been on a fat bike, it's a workout and it can really be tough, and you can become a sweaty, dripping person very quickly, and then you lead yourself into hypothermia and you got to deal with making sure you have something dry to put on. But thankfully everybody did well. We taught them about how to properly dress, keep hydrated. Dehydration is one of the number one risk factors for dogs and humans on any of these types of mushing races, whether it's this expedition I'm talking about or the Iditarod. Hydration is a big deal.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because I was going to bring that up as well. And it's something that is a little bit counterintuitive because you think, well, I'm out where it's so cold, I don't necessarily need to be worried about drinking water, but you absolutely do need to worry about that. It's very, very important for both the dogs and for humans. And that's actually one of the things that the vets on the Iditarod Trail check for every time they check out the dogs, is they check for how they're doing in terms of the hydration. And if a dog is not being properly hydrated, they make sure that the musher is aware of it and that that's taken care of immediately, because that can very quickly become a very serious and life-threatening thing.
Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of people, especially in warmer climates, you don't understand that you actually become dehydrated in a colder environment faster than you do in a hot environment. It's just one of those extraordinary things.
And, you know, the reason, just to circle this around again, the reason that we're talking about this and that we're spending so much time on this right now is there was the dog Smoke, who was a drop dog, had a minor wrist problem, and then died while being transported back to Anchorage. Today they said that Smoke had died of hyperthermia, and they immediately started looking at how they can change the rules for dogs being transported back from the trail to Anchorage to make sure that this sort of thing can be avoided in the future. It's not entirely clear if there were any other dogs on that plane who had any sort of trouble. I know that's something that several journalists are looking into, and when we hear more about that, we'll certainly bring it to you guys. But it is, you know, we heard about this yesterday. It's still a very, very new story that we're talking about, and I am really pleased that Mark Norman and Stu Nelson and the folks running the Iditarod Trail Committee took this very, very seriously and immediately went into action to try to figure out how they could change, you know, little things to make sure that this doesn't happen again.
Right, absolutely. And it's one of those things where if they had three or four dogs on the plane and one, he could have just gotten hot, you know. I don't know about you, but when I travel on airplanes, I don't dress warm because I get hot just sitting there from the anxiety of it. And that very well could have played a part, and no one will ever be able to say, oh yeah, the dog got anxious and got hot. It's a tragic situation, and the best thing we can do is look at this as a lesson and go from there to prevent it. And I think that's what the Iditarod is going to do. They've been pretty proactive about always making sure that we learn from mistakes and we move forward and don't let them happen again.
Yeah, and in the past, there has been some people have felt like there wasn't a lot of transparency with the Iditarod Trail Committee and how they reacted to events like this. There was a tragic case a couple years ago where one of the dogs, I believe possibly at Unalakleet, had been dropped, kept outside in a windstorm, and died because there was basically nobody checking on the dogs overnight. And at the time, I remember there was some criticism that they were not as transparent and not as forthcoming as they could have been. I think they've definitely learned from that. They changed the rules to make sure that is not going to happen again for the drop dogs in places, especially on the coast. So, you know, as I said, I'm really, really happy that they are taking this so seriously and acting so quickly.
Absolutely. So we've got about 5 minutes left or so. If you want to start our little discussion about our featured musher tonight, that would be wonderful.
Excellent. So our featured musher is Gunnar Johnson, and it was his birthday on Saturday at the ceremonial start. He shares a birthday with Dallas Seavey. He is technically not a rookie, although he's described himself as a born-again rookie. He ran the race exactly once, 26 years ago in 1991. And that was the year, people might remember who are longtime Iditarod fans, when there was a gigantic snowstorm up on the coast. Susan Butcher had gone out and then wound up coming back into one of the later checkpoints. Rick Swenson sort of boldly went out in the middle of the storm, went through it, and won. So that was the year that Gunnar Johnson ran the Iditarod. He finished in 54th place. He is a guy who was mentored by Jim Lanier in the 90s. And as we've you know, we've heard this a lot of times with people talking about how he and I believe his dad had gone to a presentation that Jim Lanier did about mushing and the Iditarod, and Gunnar's dad and Jim became friends. They're both doctors, and Gunnar became enamored with dog racing and with dogs. So after he finished college, he went up to Alaska for a couple years, worked as a commercial fisherman, was mentored by Jim Lanier to qualify, to, you know, complete his qualifiers and run Iditarod. And he said at the time that he was going to then go to law school, and maybe he would come back after law school and run the Iditarod again. Since then, he has he lives in Duluth, and he's continued to run shorter races for a while, mostly six dog races, distances of like 25 to 70 miles. And he and his wife finally decided to get rid of their dog team when they became parents to twin girls 14 years ago. He continued over the past 14 years to make yearly or every other year trips up to Alaska, trained occasionally with Jim Lanier and his dogs. He ran the Copper Basin in 2004 and the Denali Doubles in 2016, but mostly has been doing law. He's the city attorney in the city of Duluth. And then earlier this year, Jim Lanier, who's had knee problems and I believe either has had surgery on his knee or is about to have surgery on his knee, decided that he wasn't going to be able to run Iditarod this year. And then he sort of, you know, he went back on that a little bit and said, well, I probably could have won, but I would have been miserable for 1,000 miles, and who needs that? And Jim says that he's basically known Gunnar almost since Gunnar was in diapers. So he reached out to Gunnar and asked Gunnar to run his team, Jim Lanier's team, in the Iditarod this year. Now, of course, Gunnar hasn't been really running dogs in a serious way. He's run a couple mid-distance races, but definitely has not run a long-distance race since 1991. So he came up here in January, ran the Northern Lights 300, then came back up on February 23rd to do some intensive training for the last 10 days before Iditarod with Jim's team. And he said that he knows that he doesn't have a top 20 team, so his real goal is just to finish. And he said that the four things he wants to do is get into Nome, keep all his fingers and toes, keep his job, and keep his marriage so that his wife doesn't divorce him. And when Jim Lanier was asked about that, he said, well, that's not good enough. I don't want him finishing in the back of the pack. He's got to do better than that. He is currently in 44th place. He's got a very solid middle-of-the-pack performance right there with Anna and Christy Barrington, Alan Moore, Karin Hendrickson. So he is doing very well right now and is currently resting in Koyukuk. He's a very interesting guy. He says that he has mostly spent the last 15 years sitting behind a desk 8 hours a day. So he's looking forward to being back out in the beautiful Alaska wilderness. And it's sad that Jim Lanier, who has run the Iditarod in each of the last five decades, at least once, it's sad that Jim isn't running this year. But it's great that Jim was able to find someone who had run Iditarod before who could take his team to Nome.
Absolutely, Alex. What a wonderful story. What a great episode. We're on 20 seconds left, and we will see everyone tomorrow night at this same time. I'm sorry for the lateness, but somebody's got to work. Everybody take care. Alex, thanks so much. I'll talk to you tomorrow night.
Thanks, Michelle.
Bye-bye.